This meeting is now being recorded.
So this is today, September 16th at last seminar. Harley Thronson is, as they say, on assignment. My name is Sean Domingo-Goldman. I'm your host today, filling in for Harley. And our speaker today is Selma de Mink from the University of Amsterdam, and she'll be speaking on the wonderful lives of massive stars until their final explosions and beyond, which sounds really exciting. Selma, go ahead and take it away.
Hello, everyone. I'm Selma. I'm calling in through Skype from the Netherlands, from Amsterdam, so I hope the connection will do. I brought three students in my office here to have a feeling of a normal audience. I would love to take some questions while I'm talking, just to have a feeling that there's anyone there that will probably be a bit interruptive, but we'll suffer through it.
And Selma, just so you know, we do have a live audience here at Goddard of about 10 or 12 people. So.
Okay, that's great. Okay, good to know. And how many people are online?
I've heard Carl Seppelfeld online. Is there anyone else? Sounds like that's it.
Okay, that's great.
Sometimes people join as, you know, they might be getting lunch or something and then showing up a few minutes late.
No, that's perfect. It's a new medium for me, so I'll slowly get used to it. But, okay. I'd like to talk about massive stars today because it's a topic that we study here. And just first of all, a small disclaimer. My background is in theory of stellar evolution, not directly observations. Of course, I work together with observers, but it's very exciting to think about a new telescope. But you get a little bit of theory perspective here, so I think more in terms of questions, and we're not too far in quantifying what we would actually need. But I hope I can show you a few things that we're really excited about that happened in my community lately that's turning things around. So talking about massive stars, maybe let's go directly to my slide number 2. That's working for me as well. So my slide number 2. So massive stars are, of course, have very short lives, and very active lives, but they're very rare. And to study them by itself is already a challenge to get large samples of data. And so we need to move to nearby galaxies to get large numbers. So just the study of massive stars itself is already pushing to go for larger and larger distances. Otherwise, our samples will remain very small. And as you know, massive stars are hot and bright. You see them in the background of my first slide, some of the most massive stars we have nearby. They emit most of their light in the UV. And there's many spectral features there that help us a lot to understand how much mass they lose and other processes that go on. And so which we can only access from space. And then a third reason, massive stars typically form in very crowded regions, as you can also see in the background of my first slide. And these crowded regions, they really call for a superb spatial resolution if you want to tell one massive star from the other. So I'd like to start with a little bit introduction and motivation of the open questions that we have and show you a few I think exciting things that are very puzzling at the moment. Mostly things that we learned from data with the Hubble Space Telescope, and which is raising the questions that hopefully one day a high definition telescope or ATLAS or whatever acronym will be given to it at that time might answer. So going to slide number 4, just to motivate massive stars. So we know the very first stars in the universe were probably very massive. And they were the stars that started to ionize their surroundings and that started the process of enrichment, creating all the elements that we know today. So massive stars play a huge role as cosmic engines. And at the same time, today, we use massive stars to probe the universe around us to learn about star formation in nearby galaxies, but also in the highest redshift galaxies. The light we see from these galaxies is completely dominated by the young massive stars that are forming there. And so for that reason, if you go to slide 5, just to mention many topics that that relate and are directly dependent on how well we understand massive stars. If you think about heating of the universe, reionization, chemical enrichment, about galactic scale outflows, or even seeds for turbulence in star-forming regions where younger, lower-mass stars and their planets are forming. And so all these cases, massive stars are being used in simulations for this as terms of feedback. And so for cosmic probes, the things to think about is, well, let's, for example, mention the extremely energetic explosions they give rise to. And so we need massive star models to understand them well, to understand how their progenitors evolve. And also for the highest redshift galaxies, If we want to use the light of these high-directed galaxies to infer something about the star formation history and how it developed over the universe, or about the initial mass function in these galaxies, that's not coming out of the light by itself. We need stellar models to convert this light into units and physical quantities that we know. And, of course, massive stars leave behind compact object Newton stars and black holes, which allow us to probe extreme physics of these objects. So moving to slide 6, just as an introduction, this is what we tell our students, but it's also basically the state of the art in many fields of astrophysics that make use of massive stellar models. So this is the simple picture that we have. The star starts on the main sequence, this phase in which it's hydrogen burning in its core, and it expands, become a giant or a supergiant star, probably ends its life as supernova, leaving behind a black hole or neutron star. And then some of this material is recycled into the next generations of stars. And so in this picture, we think of this star as being by itself, being a single star and isolated. So there's many aspects of this picture that are clearly much more challenging than we thought it was. So, for example, we know now that 7 out of 10 massive stars has a companion next to it. 7 out of 10. So the large majority doesn't evolve like this picture, but something much more complicated. But let's focus for a moment on one phase of the evolution, the main sequence evolution. How well do we understand this? So maybe we can go to slide number 7. Let's depict this in the most classic diagram that we have and we use in stellar evolution theory, at least, where we plot the brightness of stars versus their temperature, the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram. So let's go to slide number 8. Here I show you different models. The blue lines are evolutionary tracks of how stars evolve in this diagram. They start on the left. The most top one is for a star that started with a mass of roughly 40 solar masses. The lowest track in the diagram started roughly at 8 solar masses, if I remember correctly. And so these stars, they move, they expand, they move to the upper right of this diagram. And the first part of this evolution is very slow, which forms a theoretical main sequence. And afterwards, these stars speed up, which is shown with the dotted lines. And this would be the post-main sequence evolution. It would be very fast. And so a basic, very fundamental prediction of the stellar models is that there would be a sharp transition between the dark blue area, the main sequence, and right of it, the light blue area. So in the dark area, the density of stars, according to the prediction, should be 100 to 1,000 times more than on the right area because of the time scales that that are involved. And so the question is, how well is actually that, how well do the observations and the models compare? So in slide 9, I show you some data of one of the surveys that we're involved in here. It's a survey with the VLT Flames, the very large telescopes, one of the multi-object spectrographs there, led by the PI Chris Evans. And so the dots in this diagram show you one of the very nice samples of one of the first surveys here. And so you see these dots are spread out over this diagram, and that there's no clear signature of this end of the main sequence. So to repeat, at the end of this dark blue area, we would expect a very steep drop-off in the density of stars. And we see stars on both sides of it, and the density doesn't necessarily seem to behave. Now, these are classic stellar models. We have a lot of improvements on these models. So the picture, it maybe looks a little bit less bad, but these models that I show here are the models that are widely used for this moment. These are the models, maybe if you're familiar with the code Starburst 99, which is widely used to interpret young star-forming regions throughout the universe. In the standard setup, this is the model that you're using. And so if we go to the next slide, this is an older version of the same plot, which looks much worse. So this is slide number 10. So this problem of not knowing where the main sequence ends is an old problem that was pointed out in 1990 already. The data has improved a little bit, so the dots you see in the background here are the colors of stars observed in the Large Magellanic Cloud. But the discrepancy is striking, I think. And so all these stars in the middle, we would call them blue supergiants, or the majority of those. And these blue supergiants, it's quite embarrassing, but we don't know in what evolutionary state they are. So one solution for this discrepancy is that these blue supergiants are part of the main sequence, which would mean that they're still burning hydrogen. Another option is that they are actually in a further evolved state in which they have moved to the right side of the diagram and came back and are now helium burning. But the inside would be a completely different structure. And as you already see, there's one little dot in the center, which is an open dot. That dot is actually the progenitor star that was observed in the location of 1987A, and which is now disappeared. So there's a third option for these stars. They may actually be on the verge of exploding. So it's quite embarrassing. We have so little understanding of the stars in the middle of this diagram, and we cannot tell whether they're just in the first part of the evolution burning hydrogen, whether they're already burning helium or are burning burning helium, or whether they can explode any moment. So that's that I wanted to show as sort of the state of the art, at least how things compare with the classic models. And so what we're trying to do is to understand what gives all the variation here, and we try to get better samples of data. This is just the Large Magellanic Cloud. Two of the things we're extremely interested in is to find more data points moving upward in this diagram towards the most massive stars. There's not many of them, and we will soon have to move beyond our local group to find data points to fill the upper part of the diagram. And the second thing we're interested in is to see how this changes if we think about stars that were formed a little bit earlier in the universe when the metal content was a little bit lower. The metal content here is about half of what we have in the solar neighborhood, but we know the first stars would have basically zero metals, and we try to understand them. So, if we want to move to regions with lower metallicity, and we want to do similar studies, we need other equipment. So moving to slide 11, so this was my motivation. I want to show you a few puzzles or excitement that have been brought to the surface by data taken with the Hubble Space Telescope and also the Very Large Telescope. So a part of this is also the same VLT Flame survey of massive stars, and the collaboration that is working on that is a collaboration I'm indebted to. So on the next slide, slide 12, you see one of the amazing HST images of this region. And the background, you see the entire nebula, the Tarantula Nebula. It's actually one band with Hubble and two ground-based bands. It was released as one of the birthday images of Hubble's 23rd birthday, I believe. And so in the center, you see this very dense star cluster, and bright and shining full of massive stars. And if you move to slide number 13, and this is the first puzzle, we have recently learned that in the center of this star cluster, there are stars that are very massive, much more massive than we thought massive stars were supposed to be, much more massive than the most massive stellar models that are widely used. And so the typical upper stellar mass limit that is being employed until recently was around 100 solar mass, maybe 120 solar mass. There was no real reason for it. It's just the old grid of models didn't go further, and we didn't have evidence for stars more massive, so there was no need to make more models. But this has changed mainly by the work by Paul Crowther. I'll say a little bit more about it. But in the very center, there's claims for stars being between 200 and 300 solar masses at birth at the moment. This is just the region nearby. Of course, one of the big questions we have is this a peculiar place, or is this happening in many places in the universe? But this is the only place we can access with Hubble at this moment. But so that's raising many exciting questions. And then the question, of course, is also, are these stars born that massive, or maybe they are formed through other processes? We know many massive stars are found in binary systems. Maybe some of these are actually stars that have fused together, making more massive stars. So there's a lot of research ongoing in that direction. Moving to slide 14, I'm quickly summarizing the puzzles. I'll go in a few in more details in a moment. But on slide 14, the second puzzle is something we learned from this region, but also studies in our own galaxy. It's full of binary systems. Nearly every massive star you look at turns out to have some sign of a companion. In our own galaxy, we find evidence that 7 out of 10 massive stars has a companion, not only a companion, but a companion that is so extremely close that they will interact with each other. And so in this region, we could test that. We found a little bit lower fraction, but we think that's actually an effect of age, but it's still the majority of the massive stars in here are in very close binary systems. And so besides the general statistics, in this region, we find many interesting new records. There's one paper coming out the discovery of the most massive over-contact binary system. So imagine two stars that are actually so close that they're actually in contact, sort of a, forming some sort of peanut shape system that is in contact now. We don't know for how long. It's most likely that it will merge very soon. So that's a paper that was recently accepted. It will be out soon. We found the very first X-ray binaries in this region and many more. We found the most massive binary with evolved O star giants. So this is why we call this region basically the massive star deep field. Partially because this region is a region we observe with many different telescopes and different wavelengths. But it's also one of the regions where we're breaking every record we thought possible in stellar evolution. So moving to the next slide, slide 15. We do find some stars that are not in binaries, and it turns out that many of these are rotating extremely rapidly. Well, we find all stars are rotating, but typically maybe 20 or 30% of their maximum speed or their breakup speed. So breakup speed would be the speed at which the material, the equator, would actually fly off the star. So most stars rotate around 20 or 30%, but there are outliers. And so one is the example that I'm showing on the bottom of this slide with a small artist impression of what we think this star might look like. And so it's rotating so fast, its projected rotation rate of the equator is over 500 kilometers a second, possibly 600, with a big error bar. But so we think this star is rotating so fast that material is no longer bound at the equator and is being flung into a disk surrounding the star. And we have two of these extreme ones rotating around this speed in this sample. And so especially for on the theory side, it's extremely exciting to think, what would such a crazy rotation do to the evolution of this star? Are the stellar models actually correct for stars that are rotating like this? Okay, so moving to the next slide, slide 16. A further puzzle, that's the fourth and the last one I'll show here, is we see many stars moving. And so part of the motion we see through the spectroscopic data taken from the ground. We also have an HST program to look at the proper motion of these systems. And with HST, we can actually measure the positions accurately enough that we should be able to detect anything moving faster than maybe 30, 40 kilometers a second if Jay Anderson is not being too optimistic, but he's the expert in this area. So, so that would be amazing to think what you could do with HDST. Like telescope, what kind of motions you could recover. And then now it's extremely pushing the limits, but then it would be just a piece of cake. So one of the stars that had a very strange radial velocity is the star pointed out on the side there. The arrow is mispointing, but it was a very extreme beast, a star of 80 solar masses. It's one of the more massive stars, maybe not 200, but 80 solar masses is one of the heavy weight ones in this regime. And it's moving, I believe it's moving towards us with a speed that is much higher than we see in the rest of the environment. And so the question is, what makes stars move like that? And so there's two scenarios for this. One way to do this is that maybe this star had an interaction, a very close encounter with a binary system, or it was part of a binary system, and a third star came in. And these three stars, they had a near collision, which led to very chaotic behavior, shooting out one of these three stars. So something like this is not very likely to happen normally in normal regions, but it could possibly happen in that very dense center, in a very dense cluster in the center. So possibly the star was shot out from there. And so typically when three stars have a near collision like that, it is the least massive star that's being shot out. So meaning that there's two stars more than 80 solar masses that participated in this little dance. So that is consistent with this crazy high masses being inferred for the stars in the very center. It's not the only runaway star we find here. We find many more. And so there's a second way to shoot out stars, and that is when stars are initially in a binary system. But when the first star explodes, the second star can also get a very large velocity. And so for the first time, we have what we now think is a very large sample of nearly 20 stars that are running away We think this is very exciting from to understand what massive stars are doing, to understand the explosion possibly of the companion star. But this also has implications for if some of you are more interested in the evolution of galaxies or early galaxies. If such stars would be forming in these very compact early galaxies, with these velocities, they would actually be able to almost escape their galaxies and move into regions where there's not much gas around, and all their ionizing photons would become available to ionize the intergalactic medium. And so this is the idea proposed by Conroy and collaborators, which is very exciting. But we're finally getting data for this, and we're excited now about a sample of 20 runaway stars, but imagine if we can do this for real and have the statistics for this. So from here, moving to slide number 17, it is just going back to the picture I showed you in my introduction and motivation. So this is all raising many new questions. So we know massive stars play a huge role, both in transforming the universe as it was after the Big Bang into the universe in which eventually the Earth managed to form, and also plays a huge role in how we now use the light of distant galaxies to learn about them. And in all these applications, we have been using simple models of single stars. And now we know the story is much more complex. We know the upper mass limit we have been adopting is probably on the lower side. We know the large majority finds themselves in interacting binary systems, and their properties can severely change. We know at least several of them have a crazy high rotation rates, which must change their evolution and structure, as I'll show you after this. The star's running away, and so there's many other questions, but these four are the ones I'm most excited about. And to answer these questions, we need to go beyond this region of 30 Doradus and see if these properties we find here are universal. Okay, I want to go in a bit more detail in the example of the most massive stars. So slide 18 is introducing that. Turning my papers here. So let's go to slide 19. The story of how massive is the most massive star in this region is an old story. The first claims before we had resolved this region was people were so surprised there was so much light coming from such a dense region that there were claims that this was a star of around 1,000 solar masses. Very nice papers about this. But eventually the brightest stars could be resolved first from the ground and later with the Hubble Space Telescope, which is showing it's definitely not one star but several, which brought the upper mass limit down at first, but recently has it brought it up to 200 again by because of the better spectra that were taken. So going to slide 20, you see an overview. It's not one star. There's four stars, or superstars, as Paul Crowther likes to call them, but four stars that are definitely over the 120 solar mass limit. So you see here they're named A1, A2, A3, and star C. And A1 and A2 are very close together, just 0.1 arc second together. So we really needed HST to resolve them in two, in this crowded region at least. So you see their masses. The second line gives the current mass, so it's our best estimate of how massive they are now. And you see the arrow bars are huge. The first one is maybe 265 solar masses plus 80 minus 35, which is very large arrow bars, but it's well above 120 solar masses with quite some certainty. But being this mass today means that it should have been born with even more mass, because we know these stars have huge stellar winds that blow off the surface layers. Actually, huge stellar winds, inferring those properties is also something where we absolutely need the UV. So this star, we think it started with over 300 solar masses. And you see the other examples there. So going to the next slide, so the question is, can we do better? Well, we're trying to as good as we can at the moment. So this is still an HST program, the spectrograph STIS, led by Paul Crowther. This is a program that is in progress. In the design of this program is to put the spectrograph on top of the star cluster, which you see in the background here, and the different slits are shifted to try to get spectra of each of these stars. But you see crowding is definitely an issue here as well. But we can show some early results of this. So going to slide 22, this preliminary results, and I thank Paul and Saida Caballero Nieves for allowing me to show their preliminary results at least. So on this slide, in the background, you see an Hertzsprung-Russell diagram. That are quite likely to be over 100 solar masses. And the four original ones, they're still taking the lead on top of this diagram. So that's not the only thing that's coming out. For the most massive stars, they're complicated to analyze, but a little bit slightly less massive stars, the O-type stars, we can derive a bit more information. And this survey was consisted of two epochs, so the spectra were taken at two times. And just by taking two epochs, we already saw that 35% of the O-type stars is moving, and most likely because of the presence of a very close binary companion. That's the only likely explanation. So with just two epochs, we already find that over a third is in a binary system. If you do the completeness for this, it is basically, practically all of these need to be in binary systems. So going to the next slide, slide 23. So what are the implications of this? So these stars with masses over 100 solar masses, they disproportionately contribute to the light of such star clusters. And especially the ionizing flux of such star clusters and spectral features that might pop up. And so these stars are not included in stellar population synthesis models like Starburst 99, or there's a code called BPAS that actually accounts for binaries, or Roussel-Chalot code that maybe some of you might be using. And so if you don't account for these stars, you will severely underestimate the ionizing fluxes of these populations. It actually leads to overestimating the age and overestimating the metallicity. So these are systematic effects that we should be worrying about if we use these models without accounting for these most massive stars, even if we look at the most distant galaxies. And so, it's still challenging for me to be quantitative by just learning about all the amazing probabilities that we might have someday in the future with a real successor of Hubble. But so some of the questions for me that are exciting is trying to understand, is there a real universal upper mass limit? This is just the nearest cluster we can do this exercise. But what if we could do that for all the clusters accessible nearby? And also, one of the most exciting things, if we're able to resolve structures of 100 parsec everywhere in the universe, as some of the advocates are claiming a telescope like this may do, we can at least get the spectra of such regions that would just be the spectra of a starburst like this. And so we will see features of systems like this in the integrated UV spectra of starbursts. And if they're very young, it should be these stars that are dominating these features. So doing that everywhere in the universe seems beyond my imagination still, but very exciting. I want to move to a second example. So that will be slide 24 is introducing that. So I'm moving more to something I'm a bit more familiar with, which is the stellar models. So I'm going to show you the predictions that come from some of the stellar models, which are potentially very exciting and high impact. But keep in mind, these are predictions, and what we really need is to test these predictions. But let me show you what rotation might do to massive stars. So moving to slide 25, again, an Hertzsprung-Russell diagram showing the brightness versus the effective temperature. And I showed again a few evolutionary tracks of how a star would evolve of stars for different masses, 16 to 60 solar masses. And I showed this for a little bit low metallicity, similar to the Small Magellanic Cloud, but that's the detail. So these will be tracks for slow rotating stars. They start in the middle of this diagram and they expand and they move to the right of this diagram, as the cartoon on the top is illustrating. That's very close to what the classic models would do. These have a bit updated physics, but the differences are very small. Moving to the next slide, on slide 26, for stars that are rotating very rapidly, possibly as rapid as shown in this artist impression, these structure models start to behave very differently. And so there's two physical effects that we know would be occurring in these stars. One of them is these fast rotating stars. They're slightly deformed, as you also see in this artist impression. So they're a bit flatter than you might expect from a star that's supposed to be round and spherical. And so this flattening actually triggers instabilities in the interior of the star that leads to large-scale circulation, or Eddington-Sweet circulation. And the first cartoon on the left gives you an impression of what such a circulation could look like. So large-scale circulations from the pole to the equator. And these circulations happen in the outer part of the star, which is not supposed to undergo any mixing processes. And suddenly these circulations can actually transport elements in these layers that's supposed to be stable when the star was not rotating. The second effect will be shear mixing. Every star, as they evolve, if they have a little bit of angular momentum, they naturally develop layers that rotate with different angular velocity, and they will shear, and this shear will create little eddies. And it is also a way to transport elements from the interior to the surface. And in the very extreme case, this can have dramatic consequences for how these stars evolve. So in the for slow rotators, we see as I showed you in the cartoon on the top of this diagram, and the stars develop a core and an envelope, and the boundary between the core and the envelope is very sharp. So the core would be helium-rich, and the envelope would remain hydrogen-rich and is inflating. And so this sharp transition is crucial to decide that these stars expand. If you want to know what rotating stars do, then have a look at the next slide. It will be slide 27. And so here in blue, I show you some of the predictions of rotating stellar models for extremely rapid rotation. I show you on purpose a very extreme example, so you will remember how big the differences are. Maybe let me first say that if I would take moderate rotation rate, they would look very similar to these red tracks, the slow rotators. But a very fast rotation, we might have this crazy behavior where stars don't expand, but they actually move leftwards in this diagram, and they shrink, becoming bluer and bluer. And so the cartoon above tries to give you some intuition for why this is happening. So I told you that these stars undergo much more efficient mixing processes that can bring material from the center to the equator. And as a result, there is no transition between the core and the envelope. And they're nicely mixed. So all the hydrogen that is fused into helium into the center is mixed to the surface. And this entire star is slowly converting into more helium-rich and helium-rich material. And since helium, one helium atom is taking less space than four protons, the four hydrogen atoms, or, well, bare protons, of course, all everything is ionized. And so it takes less space, so the star is basically contracting for this reason, becoming extremely hot. And so this is a type of evolution that we have been calling chemically homogeneous evolution, a prediction by the model. There's a few hints that this might be happening in reality. We see some features that are very well explained by this, but a solid proof that this is happening is not found. But the interesting implications are, if you go to the next slide, on slide 28. So on 28, I'm trying to show you that these strange effects for these very fast rotators, we mainly expect them to happen at low metallicity. And so especially if we would go back to further distances and start to probe regions in which the metal content is much lower, we should find more and more of these stars. So in the diagrams here, I showed you the top diagram is the same diagram I showed you before, only it's a bit rescaled. In the center and the lower diagram, I show you the same tracks, evolutionary tracks for slightly higher metallicity, for the Large Magellanic Cloud and for something like the solar neighborhoods. In the lowest panel, you see that the red and the blue curves both go nicely to the right, and both stars behave pretty normal. And that's because in the solar neighborhood, the metallicity is so high that these stars drive stellar winds, and that spins them down. And so for a while, these stars are a little bit different than non-rotating stars. You see small deviations between the red and the blue tracks, but very quickly they spin down and start to behave like normal stars. So this has many implications. Probably, if this is really happening, one of the big questions is, what would it do to the chemical yields of such stars? If they rotate and bring all this material to the surface, and on top of that, they will have much more massive cores, and so the way they explode at the end of their life might be very different. So, second implication to think about is, if stars like this were around during the epoch of reionization, it appears that they can make many more ionizing photons than normal stars. So maybe this is a way to provide extra ionizing photons and solve some of the missing ionizing photon problems that we seem to have, although there's other ways to explain this as well. The third option, that's actually has been the main reason to start thinking about these models again, is that this type of very fast spinning, fully helium models are progenitors, are the very good progenitors for a long gamma ray burst in the collapsor scenario proposed by Stan Woosley. So you need a very compact and fast spinning star. If it wouldn't be compact, the jets could not get out of the star and survive. But only in these compact stars we could produce long gamma ray bursts. And the fourth implication is that if you have some of these stars nearby, for example, in very metal poor regions, these stars are so hot, you might mistake them for top three stars, the stars we are so desperately after to find. And so it's very tempting to, as soon as you see evidence for a very strong ionizing sources in a regime where your classic models don't predict it, to possibly propose there's POP3 stars there. These stars would not be POP3 stars there. They have some metal content, but they their spectra might to some extent mimic that of POP3 stars. So we have a recent paper on that. And so one of the most exciting things for me is if we would have a Hubble 2.0, we would be able to study galaxies like this galaxy that Sally Heap, who's online or there as well, is an expert in, Wanzwicki 18, which is a very low metallicity, at least 30 times lower than solar, possibly 50. I don't know what the last statements are. And so that is so much lower in metallicity that it really starts to give us insight in the earlier generations of stars and what they look like. It's a 20 megaparsec, so at the moment it's limited what we can do, although I'm extremely impressed of what Sally Heap still gets out of it. But it would be amazing if we could close to resolve the brightest beast in this. And of course, stars like this, they would leave imprints also on the more distant starbursts. So resolving every feature of 100 parsec throughout the universe and taking spectra of such regions, we should really be able to understand what's going on here. So last example I wanted to give, going to slide 29, not a full example, but I want to highlight it because it's really changing at the moment how we think about massive stars. So we know massive stars like to be in binaries. If you look well enough, almost all of them seem to have a companion. And so let me go to slide 30 right away. So the results we have, as I already mentioned, from studies in our own galaxy is that the presence of companions is so extremely common that 7 out of 10 massive stars is expected to interact with the companion. So the majority of massive stars doesn't evolve like the classic single star models predict. But the majority will do something like you see depicted in the background of this picture, where one star will strip the envelope of the other star. And so the little pie chart you see there is giving an impression of what they think might be happening to these stars. So in this 29%, plus or minus a good error bar, but plus or minus 10%, but about one-third is stars, they're probably still in binary systems, but either the binary is so wide or the companion is so low mass that it's practically evolving like a single star. But around 30% would be should be pretty well described by the classic stellar models, at least by the single star models. So of the remainder, there will be a large fraction that will be the star that is losing mass in a binary system. Roughly one-third will experience envelope stripping, as the yellow part of this pie chart is showing. In the order of 15% or so would be the stars that are gaining mass and accreting, and that are spinning up. And maybe those spin-up stars would be the stars that we see now so fast rotating. Maybe those are the stars that undergo this strange evolutionary scenario that I showed you in the previous example, the stars that mix completely. Maybe not nearby, but at lower metallicity regions, that would be a good option. And so the final option is, it turns out the number of very close binary systems is so extremely high that a very large fraction of these stars will already interact during their main sequence evolution very early on, and a very large fraction of these stars are expected to merge together. And so we see some of these stars that are in contact, similar to this this cartoon picture of this is showing. And we don't know how long these things live. We don't know how for how long they can stay like this. But if a quarter of the stars born is fusing like this, that is changing the picture. Go to the next slide, slide 31. So the big questions we have here, the regions where we can study this are extremely limited. We have two Magellanic clouds available, which is great. They cover two different metallicities. We try to do it in our own galaxy, for now having the trouble that we usually typically don't know the distances, but at least Gaia will help us there. But after that, it's close to impossible to do studies like this. And so the big question is the binary fraction universal of if we would go to a wider range of regions, a wider range of regions with different densities, does this still hold? Maybe part of this can still be done from the ground with the 20, 30, 40 meter class telescopes. But to look for the imprints of binarity, I think, especially in the UV, we should do that from space. Another area where which would be very interesting to pursue is that suddenly it should be fairly straightforward to find very, very low mass companions, which we have almost no other means to detect. But it's quite similar to trying to find a planet next to a normal star. Finding a low mass companion to a massive star is a similar challenge. I'm sorry. So I'm going to round off already a little bit. So going to slide 32, let me try to put this in context of some of the diagrams that that some of your colleagues have been putting forward. So slide 33, this is a slide I stole from, I think it's from Jason Tomlinson, but I don't know who produced this slide, but it's an amazing slide. So this is showing us what we can achieve presently with the Hubble Space Telescope from JWST and with possibly one design of the High Definition Space Telescope in at least this setting. And so within this diagram, what are the things I'm interested in? I highlighted that on slide 34. So 34, I've been talking about the region 30 Doradus, which is at 50 kiloparsec. And so in 30 Doradus, my two arrows show you what we're doing now with HST and where we can go with a telescope like this. So we discussed these most massive stars and the trouble to resolve them. So one of the big questions still is how reliable are these measurements of these extremely high masses? And one of the biggest questions at the moment, are they really single stars, or is it possible that there's other stars that if we resolve this further, it will break down in yet another tiny substar cluster with different stars contributing to the light? So Paul Crowther has made several arguments that he doesn't think that it's likely that they're actually this mass, but we better try to study this this for real. A telescope like this, as I already mentioned, I think for me the most exciting thing is that it will suddenly bring dwarf galaxies nearby within reach. For example, OneZwicky 18 that I mentioned before, where we should be able to resolve structures of about one parsec. So we can really close to do a star-by-star analysis in these galaxies, which will be amazing. And then the most mind-blowing feature still is that we, with this setup, in principle, one should be able to resolve structures of 100 parsec everywhere in the universe. So 100 parsec, that is a typical size of a star cluster like 30 Doradus. So we would be able to take spectra of systems like that, sort of one starburst. And I can barely imagine what we can solve with this. So rounding off to slide 35, just coming back as a my summary. These are the four questions I posed for you. So we know massive stars play a huge role, but we know they're immensely more complex than the widely used stellar models that we use at the moment. So I briefly discussed a few the new questions about how massive is the most massive star we have. Well, clearly we do exceed the canonical upper limit of 120 solar masses, but is this universal or is this is it only happening in this region? We see extremely high binary fractions, but there's so many companions that we have a very hard time characterizing. And how does this compare? How does this change if we go to different environments? I mentioned that we have many fast rotators, and I showed you that extreme fast rotation can give strange evolutionary pathways if you believe the models that we're coming up with. So it's reasonable that this might happen, but how often and at what rotation rate exactly, that's something we need to study. But for this, we need access to low metallicity regions that that are very hard to access. And just to bring back the runaway stars, imagine if we can capture the motion of all the stars in this 30 Dorados region down to very small velocities. Sorry, I need to... need a sip of water here. So imagine if we can resolve the motions of all these stars in this region. But the big, big question is, I would like to go back in time and not only study the massive stars that are in the Magellanic Clouds, but go beyond that. So this is what I wanted to bring to you. So slide 36, thank you for listening.
Well, thank you for that wonderful presentation. So I'm going to open up the questions in the room and then questions online. Any questions here?
So I have a question. Did you, this is Ravi Kopra from NASA Goddard. Did you have a mass measurements for these massive stars other than the star clusters? Or do you find these about 200 solar mass stars only in the star clusters?
These are only found, the claims for 200 solar masses are only found in this particular star cluster for now.
So does that mean that these are formed by the mergers of these massive stars or blue stragglers or something?
So I have trouble to fully hear your question, but I think you're asking how they are formed and if they're possibly blue stragglers.
Is it possible that they have formed by mergers? Then, like you suggested, then if isn't it a circumstantial evidence that if they are found only in the star clusters?
Yes. So, we haven't been able to look in many other places, but so the fact that it is a very dense star cluster is a good hint. For so far, they seem not to have a binary companion, which is something you would expect if two stars have merged. So that's the other circumstantial evidence. Possibly, but it's a bit early to say. It appears that they are so much brighter that they appear slightly younger than the rest of the star cluster. That we need to investigate further, but that is a typical property you would expect for blue stragglers. But what stands is that these stars exist. They're there. Whatever the way they form, we should account for them when we simulate populations like this.
Okay, thank you.
Hi, Selma, this is Sally, and thank you very much for a nice talk. Do I need that microphone? Oh, this will work. Okay. I have several questions. One is to get your views on the precision of these mass determinations. As you know, what happens is you fit the spectrum of the star to determine the temperature, and from the temperature then you estimate the bolometric correction, and from that you get the bolometric luminosity, and from that you derive the mass. And it seems to me that the most of what you're measuring or estimating is a bolometric correction. It's more than three magnitudes. And so if you make a mistake in the temperature, you're going to make a big mistake in the mass. And so I was wondering, do you have views of on those very high masses that you showed? I guess they were Paul Crowther's. How real those masses are?
DSL, yeah, that's a great question, and actually you're the expert on this part and not me. So yes, the mass estimates are very uncertain, and the bolometric correction is a very challenging aspect in this. So from my side, let me answer this from the theory side, because you're much more an expert on the complications in the correction. So one of the challenges is the question, is this one star or is there other stars contributing to the light? So that part, there is a lot of room for extra stars to sit next to it. We haven't fully resolved this. From the stellar evolution viewpoint, there's no reason for stars to stop at 100 solar masses. If you compute stellar evolutionary models, there's no physical limit that prevents stars to be more massive. It's very complex to think how such stars may form, but that it's already complex to think how stars above 20 solar masses form. There's nothing special about 100 solar masses, so I'm not surprised to find a few above this this regime. The technical questions you asked me on how to convert the light we have there to work out the bolometric luminosities, you're really more an expert in that than me, so I'll leave that to you.
Well, you lead me to my second question about whether there are other stars contributing to the light of the what you think of as a single star. And I kind of remember that you had a program to find much less massive stars associated with bright massive stars. How did that turn out? What's the lowest mass companion that you found?
So we have not, we don't have the answers of the data set yet, but so the very low mass companions would not not change this question, right? The very low mass companions would not significantly contribute to the light. We have one program with the fine guidance sensor on space telescope, which has the highest spatial resolution. It doesn't take nice images, but it gets slightly higher spatial resolution. And so for the most massive star A1, if we go back in the literature, there is a claim around 93. That there is a source next to it that has not been compensated for. So we have one program to at least try to find that source. And so that might, if that source is real, it might reduce the mass of star A1, which is currently 265. It might reduce it to, I forgot the exact number, but below, just below 150 solar masses. But that does remain that there's three others that are so massive. So, but that program is in progress. The search for extreme mass ratio companions is also exciting, but it can have many evolutionary effects to have a very low mass companion, but it would not contribute to the light and not affect the question of the most massive stars.
Right. But regardless of whether it contributes to the light, it's really important for understanding star formation and whether stars are all found in binaries or multiple companions. And so I thought, one of the things that might interest you about ATLAST or LUVOIR or whatever is that it would have a chronograph, maybe mm-hmm. not a chronograph that's good enough to detect an Earth, but it should be able to certainly go down to brown dwarfs, and you would find out how how multiple stars form. My third thing is just a comment on One's Wiki 18. That is not, can't be construed as a imposter for POP 3 stars because it, at least on the basis of having very hot stars, because the hottest star in One's Wiki 18 is only about 40,000 years old. It's not a high ionization spectrum. So just a comment.
Okay, thanks for correcting that. There's other claims of possible population 3 stars in the redshift. It was out a few months ago. I forget the Ronaldo galaxy. I forgot the details, but I think for that, I was more thinking of that galaxy.
Are there other questions here in the room? Any questions online? So I do have a question. I didn't want to preempt other people's questions. I actually have two. The first is, do you know if anyone's looked at the mass flux rate into any planets that might be orbiting some of these fast-rotating stars?
The mass flux from the stellar wind? Do you mean that the stellar wind would be accreted onto the companion?
Well, you know, just thinking if you've got a star that's rotating even a significant percentage of the escape velocity for that star, any stellar activity, it seems like the high energy and the particle fluxes to any planets in that system would be much higher than it would be around a slower spinning star.
So for as we stand today, there's no detection of planets around such massive systems. And the question is also, would they be able to form under the ionizing radiation and the short time scales that in which these massive stars form? There have been claims that, so I showed this picture of this very rapidly rotating star, which has an outflowing disk. There have been claims that under some circumstances, you might actually reach conditions for planet formation and instabilities in the disk that might lead to at least clumps and possibly planet formation. So there might be planets that actually are formed later. And then this mass outflux of the star is actually providing the material to be formed from. It's still hard to think how this ionizing radiation of this star is not doing damage to this anything that might be forming there. But it's a very nice question, but I don't think people have investigated to any depth.
Okay. Well, that was coming from an exoplanet person, not a stellar astronomer. So, and then the second question is for the telescope. It sounds like the two things that you really require here are a very good spatial resolution for your observations, and also good UV spectra of your targets. Is that accurate? And what else would you be looking for the characteristics of a next generation telescope?
So I feel a bit uncomfortable on this side because I'm really on the model side. But yeah, you're right. That seems to me the two most exciting features. I didn't go too much in the UV spectroscopy, but missing any UV opportunity is that there is very important diagnostics to understand what massive stars are doing, especially to understand how the stellar winds work of these massive stars. It's not my main expertise, but in my field, the big despair at this moment is how are we going to solve this problem? How stars blow off their own envelopes without access to good UV spectroscopy. Besides the high resolution with it, also the stable, the possibility to do very accurate astrometry is very exciting, just to follow all the motions in systems like this and how stars are not only moving around in binary systems but in subgroups that maybe have imprints of the dynamics of the clouds before, and all the stars that are being shot out by as runaway stars. I think the proper motion perspective is also something that is extremely interesting for this field.
Sean, could I just answer your question in a different way? Having a large aperture means you have high light gathering power, and so you can go deeper and get those UV spectra of distant sources.
For a larger sample size.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. A bigger chunk of glass raises all boats somehow, right? Well, thank you again for a wonderful seminar. I thought that was clear and thorough and very informative, at least to exoplanet folks like me. So I'm going to end the telecon here unless there are other questions, and we'll see you all hopefully next week.
Thank you very much.
Selma, if you're still there, thank you very much. That was wonderful. Nope, I think I ended it. Yep.